Hello and welcome to the Political History of the United States, Episode 5.8, Shay's Rebellion. Welcome back. Last time, we concluded our episode by looking at the Annapolis Convention, and that, largely expected, decision that an agreement on interstate commerce would be impossible without first addressing other deficiencies in the Confederation. During our next episode, we are going to turn our attention towards figuring out how exactly the states, which were being torn apart by sectional differences, would all agree to come together, with the exception of Rhode Island, outside of Congress, to discuss the future of the government. The Annapolis Convention took place from September 12th until the 14th in 1786. What John Dickinson, Alexander Hamilton, and the other attendees were unaware of is that as they met, ostensibly to talk about interstate commerce, Western Massachusetts was in crisis. As it happened numerous times over the previous few years, violence had broken out in a population that was being buried under a tax burden that they were unable to shoulder. Led by the farmer and veteran of Bunker Hill, Daniel Shays, this uprising would illustrate to everybody just how weak the Confederation had truly become. This week, we are going to, first, move through the events of Shays' Rebellion and figure out exactly what got everybody so upset and what they planned to do about it. Then, during our next episode, we are going to fit it into its greater overall context and discuss its legacy. Shays' Rebellion is, in many ways, a microcosm of the entire Confederation era. At the very core of the rebellion are those same pressures that came from high taxation and excessive debt collection that was actively plaguing the rest of the states. However, as historian George Van Cleve explains in his book, We Have Not a Government, the situation inside of Massachusetts was still largely characterized by local circumstances. As we are going to see by the end of our episode today, this is going to have a lasting impression on what the rebellion's ultimate legacy would be. In the years since the end of the war, Western Massachusetts had become mired in an economic depression. Although this was hardly unique during those years, the economic downturn that hit this region during the mid-1780s was deeper than most, with little relief coming from the government. As though rubbing salt on an open wound, Massachusetts also took time to aggressively pursue and prosecute debtors. By the time that the rebellion had broken out, the jails were filled to the brim with debtors. This brings us to the obvious question. Why were conditions in the western part of Massachusetts so much more conducive to an uprising? Much of the problem came from the political makeup of Massachusetts in the years after the war, and the concentration of representation within the state. The problem that afflicted the state during 1786 was in many ways simple. Western farmers were stretched thin from a mixture of high taxation and high debt loads, while simultaneously lacking the money to pay said obligations. This alone was nothing terribly unique in the country, especially in the rural areas of the United States during the Confederation years, although the situation in Massachusetts may have indeed been worse than in other places. What made the problem even more pronounced, however, is that the Massachusetts government was not just deaf to the plight of the Western farmers, but they were outright hostile to suggestions of reform. Government inside of Massachusetts was a complicated affair that, since well before the Revolution, had largely been conducted at the local level. Sure, there was a state government based out of Boston, but outright ignoring Boston was a tried and true practice. In one key example, per state law, there were wealth limits that dictated who and who could not vote. In rural Massachusetts, these limits were, maybe, taken under advisement, although more often than not, they were just outright ignored. By 1786, the Western farmers were drowning in debt and needed relief at the state level. When they did turn to the state for help, what was the response, you ask? Well, in response to these many pleas for help, the government in Boston decided to wrap up business early for the year and go home, ignoring their aggrieved farmers. The problem that the leadership in Boston was ignoring was largely a result of economic woes that came following the end of the war. As mentioned a few moments ago, the economy everywhere was depressed. However, there is some evidence that the Depression might have been a bit more acute in Western Massachusetts, as compared to elsewhere. Wages and exports were down as agricultural prices were depressed. For a region that was made up primarily of small farms, such a reduction in agricultural prices had a serious impact. This depression alone would have been enough to get people grumbling unhappily under their breath. However, it is alone only part of what was going on. As these Western farmers were drowning in their debt, they were also being taxed to death. The tax system in Massachusetts was regressive, meaning that the more you were worth, the less you paid proportionate to your income. This meant that with a crushing tax burden pushing the Western farmers to, and often beyond, the brink of insolvency, they were paying proportionately more than the wealthy merchants living in Boston. Now, I don't think it is very difficult to understand how a situation like this would breed contempt. Between the debt load and the high taxes, people were struggling just to keep the lights on. However, even here, this doesn't fully explain why everything so dramatically fell apart in 1786. If the financial crisis set the stage for disaster, the spark necessary to set off this conflagration that would engulf Western Massachusetts in the fall of 1786 came from the state government in Boston. We have already established that they were deaf to the pleas of their Western citizens. However, I think that this topic deserves a little bit more attention. We have two primary questions that we need to explore in order to get to the bottom of all of this. First, what action, if any, did the government take to address the grievances of its Western citizens? Second, why was the state legislature so incapable of addressing their Western problem? Although high taxes commingled with a debt crisis was the catalyst for disaster, it was the government's decision to ignore their Western farmers' pleas for help that really made the situation so dire. If anything, the state government was outright antagonistic towards them. Massachusetts during the Confederation was itself a deeply sectional state. In Boston, you tended to have a wealthier population comprised mainly of merchants and artisans. This more wealthy core of citizens took a much more aggressive stance to questions such as debt collection than the Western farmers would have preferred. Specifically, Massachusetts remained steadfastly in the camp of aggressive debt collection and had a government that strongly favored the creditor class. Making matters worse is that the state itself was interested in aggressively paying off its own debts. In the interest of doing that, the state set forth an aggressive 5-year repayment plan, which, while great in theory to get the state out of debt quickly, just piled on more and more tax load on an already deeply strained system. This, along with an agreement to actually pay congressional requisitions in 1785, meant that there was not even a glimmer of hope that relief was coming. The courts were no help for the debtors either. The courts carried unusually high costs and had a policy of assigning attorney's fees to the losing party. This means that, in the event that a person was sued in a debt collection action, if a judgment was issued in favor of the creditor, which was typically the case, the debtor would bear the cost of both attorney fees and those exceptionally high court costs. The end result of this being that the party who was in court because they had no money to begin with would acquire additional debt with few prospects of being able to pay it. Prior to the rebellion breaking out, there had been plenty of attempts by the Western farmers to plead their case to the state assembly. They looked to other states, where their use of paper currency had become something of a backdoor form of debt relief. They had suggested to the Massachusetts leadership that issuing paper currency might just be the solution here. There was a decided lack of hard specie to go around, and thus, as a function of the law of supply and demand, This led to a significant amount of inflation of the small amount of specie that was available. Unfortunately for our farmers, the pro-creditor state government had virtually no interest in acting against their own self-interest and issuing paper currency to help pay down debts. What the farmers were asking for ranged. At a minimum, they wanted relief both for those high taxes and the debts. Again, here, paper currency seemed like a really good way to accomplish this end. However, that did not seem to be in the cards. Judicial reform was another popular point, as the system was needlessly complicated, not to mention expensive. More ambitious people were hoping for even more sweeping reforms, including the abolition of the state senate and calls for a new state constitution. The senate was particularly hated for many in the state, who viewed it as being an unnecessary institution which existed primarily for the Boston elite. As discontent spread through the western part of the state during the first half of 1786, several counties took up steps that were very familiar to them. Committees of correspondence began to form as counties made plans to hold conventions. Now, to be clear, this was not necessarily a convention, but rather it was conventions. A handful of counties here and there coming together to make demands. The biggest of these conventions came in Hampshire County, where some 50 towns were represented. This particular convention, which met on August 22nd, came up with a list of 17 specific grievances. These were no minor charges either, but rather the kind of changes that would have required a new state constitution. The convention was advocating for the abolition of the state's upper house, and an assembly that was far more representative than it currently was, in hopes of breaking the Boston stranglehold over the government. To help this process along, the recommendation was that the surviving lower house be removed from Boston entirely and moved to a more central location. Among other proposals were plans to remake the courts, lower taxes, and address the crippling lack of available legal tender. The final demand was that this is not something that should just be shelved until a later date. The convention demanded a recall of the legislature to immediately take up their complaints. 8 weeks later, so now the end of August, just to show how serious they were, several hundred people marched on the Northampton Courthouse and demanded that the proceedings be suspended. In short order, they did the math and decided that giving out continuances to all of those pending cases was probably the way to go. This would prove to not be an isolated incident either. This episode would repeat itself in courts all throughout the region. Now, before we move on, I want to talk briefly about the men themselves. Many of these farmers who were now drowning under these crushing debt loads were veterans from the Revolution. Adding to that simmering anger is the fact that many of those now languishing in debtor's prison had just a few years before been fighting for the country's freedom. Now, on the 10th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence, they were doing everything that they could just to keep their heads above water, something which many of them were unable to do. Chase himself was indeed a veteran. He fought at both Bunker Hill and Saratoga. He had been wounded during the war. For so many of these men, they had given up so much, received so little. And for what? To see a government made up primarily of men who had never once sniffed a battlefield, completely ignoring their very real problems. To say that it did not sit right with them would be an understatement. Quickly, this movement to shut down the courts spread throughout the western and central parts of the state. Although the Massachusetts government would have been plenty happy to just put their fingers in their ears and ignore the problem entirely, that just was not going to cut it. With the courts now being continually disrupted, the government was going to be forced to take notice. The solution was simple enough for Governor James Bowdoin. Other states had dealt with problems like this, and he planned to quickly nip it in the bud. Governor Bowdoin called in the militia to put an end to all of this nonsense. Unfortunately for the governor, this is the moment where he would figure out just what a serious problem that he had on his hands. when the governor called out the Worcester militia. They not only refused him, but many decided to join up with a growing number of protesters. This defection of the militia was not an isolated incident either. Throughout the remainder of 1786, this scene repeated itself over and over again. Groups of angry people would move on the courthouses and convince the local judges that it was a pretty good time to wrap up their business for the day. The militia would be sent out to get control of the situation, and then in large numbers the militia would defect over to the protesters. On August 16th in Great Barrington, nearly 800 members of a 1,000-man militia defected over to the growing rebel cause. So, obviously, this is a problem for Governor Bowdoin. The question quickly shifted to what to do if he couldn't exactly trust the militia to make things better. For some, the reaction was brutal reprisals to put this rabble back into its place. Among the biggest proponents of this camp was none other than our old friend, the reactionary arch-conservative Samuel Adams. Now, if you're sitting there saying, "Hey, Alan, I'm pretty sure that the last time we saw Samuel Adams, he was pretty much the leader of the rabble. What gives?" Well, I don't blame you. As it turns out, Adams believed that the actions of the rebels were a crime against the Republic. A crime that, in his opinion, should have been punished with nothing less than death. Although I believe the term hypocrite might be going through your mind right now concerning Samuel Adams, his position amongst the leadership was hardly unique. Sure, the rebels were taking a page directly out of the Sam Adams playbook. However, neither he nor his contemporaries would have really seen it that way. John Adams felt the same as Samuel Adams did. Men like Rufus King and John Hancock agreed as well. They truly believed that following the revolution, the situation had fundamentally changed, and that actions that were not only permissible but necessary against George III were anathema to the functioning of a healthy republic. Perhaps of more serious consequence was that although the Massachusetts elite was horrified by what was going on, for many regular citizens, there was a good deal of sympathy towards the rebels. Although many were not exactly supportive of violent action, they were at least sympathetic to the grievances of those farmers. There was likewise a constant worry that, at some point, the military was going to be called in to quash the uprising. Among the non-insurgent public, there resonated a deep fear that such an uprising would come at a steep cost in human life and suffering. This caused additional headaches for Governor Bowdoin. Should he act overly aggressively towards the farmers, he ran the risk of convincing those who were sympathetic but uninvolved with the uprising to become involved. It meant that, at least initially, rather than coming out and crushing the rebellion, Bowdoin was going to have to at least make some overtures towards meeting the farmers' demands. With Bowdoin's hands tied and him being forced to at least dangle an olive branch for the farmers, his efforts would prove to be woefully inadequate. The insurgents, now referring to themselves as regulators, would successfully shut down courts throughout virtually all of western Massachusetts by the end of 1786. Concord would prove to be the only courthouse that would remain open in the west. Although there were disruptions in the eastern half of the state, by the end of the year the uprising had mostly petered out in that region, although there remained a whole lot of sympathy for those who were continuing on in their fight. In his attempt to bring the uprising to an end, that October, Bowdoin decided to reach out and offer that olive branch. There were some attempts at tax reform, including allowing some alternative payment options on back taxes, as well as pushing the due date for the 1786 taxes from January 1st to April 1st. Likewise, the government agreed to sell off a chunk of Maine and apply the proceeds to the public debt. There were a few other actions as well that would likewise help open up access to the courts, by reducing the onerous legal fees. Finally, in exchange for an oath of allegiance, Bowdoin was magnanimously willing to offer a pardon to all of those who had disrupted court proceedings. The problem with all of this is that it fell woefully short of actually addressing the underlying issues. What the farmers really wanted was for the government to accept paper currency to settle debts, which would have, in turn, led to far more sweeping debt relief. However, here, the legislature was unwilling to budge. Probably unsurprisingly, those calls for greater government reform, including the rewriting of the state constitution, were unceremoniously ignored. Even in those places where the legislature had agreed to give at least some ground, all of the relief was meant to be temporary. The reduced legal fees and the alternative payment option had expiration dates. Making matters worse is that mixed in with these tepid offers of relief were threats that were designed to bring the regulators to heel. Among the more troubling provisions was the Riot Act, which operated as a grant of immunity for any official who killed a regulator, who either refused to stand down or resisted capture. Finally, for any insurgent who did find themselves in custody, they were to forfeit all of their lands, be jailed for a year, and receive regular corporal punishment. In order to address those militiamen who either failed to show up or defected into the ranks of the regulators, a law was passed that their punishment was to be death. As a final cherry on top of all of this, Bowdoin went ahead and suspended the writ of habeas corpus until July 1787, giving officials the chance to arrest any regulator who might find themselves far away from home. The suspension of habeas corpus deserves just a moment more of our time, because this was no small decision. Suspended on November 10th, it granted a huge deal more power into the hands of the governor. With pesky protections like due process now out of the way, the governor had the power to arrest virtually at will. Anybody whom he or his council deemed to be dangerous to the state's government could now be arrested without any hope of recourse or protection from the overreach of the state. To be clear, this decision was not mere puffery either. By the end of November, Bowdoin was ordering men arrested for their involvement in the uprising. Although order in some parts of the state was mostly restored by the end of the year, in the West, there was little hope of a peaceful resolution. The regulators were not interested in stepping down without significant reform, far more significant than what was being offered by Bowdoin in the fall. Neither the governor nor the legislature had any interest in giving into the demands of the rabble. Now, critically, throughout 1786, this rebellion had remained a mostly peaceful affair. Threats of violence were very common, and had been a staple of the courthouse interruptions since the summer. However, there had not actually been any widespread outbreaks of violent resistance. At the end of the day, despite a whole lot of grumbling, the judges and officials running those western courts backed down to avoid the confrontations. Likewise, it is not an accident that we are this deep into the episode and we have not really talked about Daniel Shays yet. The uprising was something taking place largely at a local level. Sure, a lot of places were looking at each other for encouragement, and there were those who took a more leading role, but this was not some strictly organized affair. Yet, with it now becoming clear that the regulators were not making plans to back down, the fact remained that something needed to be done to re-establish control. If that was not going to come through the state's olive branch, then restoring order was going to have to come at the end of a musket. Herein lied a very serious problem for both the state, and as we are going to see in a moment, the Confederation government. Of course, Bowdoin could have called in the militia to try and put the uprising down. That is the very thing that he had already done. Unfortunately, the militia, much to his considerable chagrin, was just as likely to abandon their posts and join the regulators. So it is probably pretty understandable when we say that Bowdoin had some serious trust issues when it came to his militia. The events in Massachusetts had not gone unnoticed by the Confederation government either. Secretary of War Henry Knox had found himself particularly concerned over a large arsenal located in Springfield. Although the regulators had not made a move on the arsenal as of yet, they had also convinced the local militia to leave it unguarded, which essentially meant that at any time, the insurgents could march in and take it unopposed. Knox was, again understandably, worried about this possibility, and suggested to Congress in October that they raise a force to restore order in Massachusetts. Now, if you have been following along, you can probably guess the problems with this. The Confederacy was again about to be exposed, as all of those shortcomings and their inability to get this rebellion back under control were laid out for all to see. By the fall of 1786, when this request was being made, the Confederation was a collection of states torn apart by sectionalism and completely insolvent. Even had Congress been interested in raising an army, they had absolutely no way to pay for any part of it. Congress understood this problem and understood the importance of regaining control over Massachusetts. Congress went ahead and sent out requisitions to the states, knowing full well how that was going to go. Convinced that nobody was going to actually pay on those requisitions, because nobody ever did, they went out looking for a loan secured by the sale of western lands to fund a response. In the end, Virginia paid a small part of the requisition, and that was it. No other states bothered to pay, and with the Confederation now in a full-scale collapse, nobody was interested in extending a line of credit. With Massachusetts needing funds that neither they nor the Confederation had to put down the rebellion, and not being able to trust their own militia, the state turned to a third option: crowdsourcing. It was in the best interest of the legislature to get control over the uprising as quickly as possible. There were two reasons for this. First and most obvious is that having an ongoing rebellion isn't exactly an ideal situation. Second, they had a vested interest in making sure that things turned out to their liking. Remember that the creditors controlled the legislature. The last thing that they wanted to have happen was for the regulators to push things to a place where they had to do something crazy, like consider taking paper money to help alleviate the debt crisis. Despite some resistance and more than a little bit of grumbling, the state was able to acquire loans from the local population to get a force assembled. By early 1787, the men were in place to try and put down the rebellion once and for all. The army sent to put down the regulators was being led by Benjamin Lincoln. Lincoln has, of course, made several appearances in our story already. He was present at Yorktown and, in fact, was the man that accepted the British surrender when George Washington refused Cornwallis's second in command. Before that, we saw him getting captured at Charleston during a particularly dark time in the war. We also saw Lincoln at Saratoga, where he had been seriously injured. Recruiting this force for Lincoln proved to be an unexpectedly difficult task. Originally, Lincoln was hoping to raise an army of right around 4,500, but he could only manage to pull together around 3,000 men. Of those who agreed to join the cause, only a small number actually came with experience. As it turns out, few veterans of the Revolution seemed terribly eager to join this particular cause, something which clues us into the general popularity of the current plans for suppression. Opposing Lincoln was Daniel Shays, who now commanded the largest group of insurgents. Shays had been reluctant to get involved at all. He himself, a Revolutionary veteran, was present at both Bunker Hill and, like Lincoln, Saratoga. Shays had been an officer during the war. By all accounts, he had fought well during the Revolution, and at one point he was presented with a sword from Lafayette himself, something which he would later have to sell, a fact that the Boston Press would use to prove that Shays was not worthy of a respectable station in life. Interestingly, that same press would paint Shays as being the ringleader of the entire uprising. the ultimate bad guy who had brought all of this down on Massachusetts so that he could make himself a dictator. Now, absolutely none of this was true. Shays was not trying to make himself a dictator. However, by this point, that fact was largely irrelevant. Shays was both outnumbered and outarmed as compared to Lincoln. To even up those odds, he turned his attention to the Springfield arsenal that had so stressed out Henry Knox back in the autumn. The problem for Shays is that this was about the most predictable target that one could imagine. And sure enough, by the time that Shays reached it at the end of January 1787, it was already reinforced by some 1,200 militia under William Shepard. As something of an ironic twist, Shepard's decision to proactively seize the armory was not exactly legal. He was in command of a Massachusetts militia regiment. The armory was controlled by the federal government. However, without the time to wait for a blessing from Knox, he decided that the prudent move was to act first and ask for forgiveness later. So then, what was the plan for Daniel Shays? What were his intentions? We know that he didn't really plan to make himself into a dictator, so what was he doing? The far more complicated truth here is that it has never been exactly clear what Shays' own intentions were, and it is a question that historians continue to debate up to this very day. Now, as historian Leonard Richards points out in his book, Shays' Rebellion, The American Revolution's Final Battle, a book which I've relied heavily upon during the making of this episode, no matter what happened after the militia got control over the Springfield arsenal, Shays' men were always in a bad spot. That 1,200-man militia guarding the arsenal was in control over not only superior weapons, but also artillery. Shays' army numbered right around 1,500 men, whose weapons were outdated at best. Some of the men lacked weapons altogether and just were rolling into battle with clubs and swords. So even though we are about to talk about some very bad luck for Daniel Shays, we shouldn't pretend that this bad luck stole away a victory for him. The situation was already bleak to begin with. The plan for Shays was a three-columned attack on January 25th. Shortly before the attack was launched, Luke Day, who was commanding the westernmost column, decided to send an ultimatum to Shepard, telling him to stand down or face destruction. With that, Day decided to give Shepard a chance to contemplate his looming doom and postponed the battle until the following day, January 26. Unfortunately, Day failed to coordinate this effort with the other two columns or even mention that he was considering such an ultimatum. He did send a note, which, yeah, that's great. However, this note got intercepted. This is all to say that the other two columns went ahead and proceeded to battle on the 25th, completely unaware that they were totally exposed on the western side. Shepard, for his part, was not exactly itching to kill fellow Americans and did attempt to fire off a few warning shots. Shepard had fired artillery over the heads of Shays' army. While the front of the army ignored the danger and bravely surged forward, the rear certainly did not. In fact, the rear panicked, turned, and ran. This meant that those men who were still moving forward were now themselves dangerously isolated and exposed. Shepard, sensing that the rebel army was now on the ropes, fired a round of grapeshot into the exposed flank, which was enough to bring the entire episode to an anticlimactic end. The grapeshot killed four, injured many others, and convinced the remainder of the men that the Springfield arsenal was not meant to be. Everybody quickly raced from the field, with survival now being their primary motivator. Really, that was pretty much it. For an event that is so famous and so well known, it may seem a little bit odd that this battle right here on January 25th was pretty much it. There was never some Lexington or Concord-style victory, some Bunker Hill where even though the position was lost, the rebels inflicted massive damage to their enemy. No. Instead, the fighting of Shays' Rebellion was borderline pathetic. Following the defeat in Springfield, Shays' army moved to the north to Pelham. Lincoln at this point was located in Hadley. Lincoln was not exactly having an easy go of things. He was not welcome throughout most of the western part of the state, and found few willing to play along as a gracious host. The exact opposite was true for Shays, who still enjoyed overwhelming popularity in the region. After briefly collecting his breath, Shays moved his men 20 miles to the north, to the town of Petersham. Now, conveniently for Shays that night, February 3rd, a blizzard blew in and brought the men some much-needed protection. Lincoln was not about to march his men through a blizzard, surrounded by unfriendly faces that were not terribly interested in offering them any kind of shelter. Except, as it turns out, that is exactly the reason why Lincoln was forced to keep marching. It absolutely was not ideal, and the conditions truly were miserable. But nobody was really coming to the aid of Lincoln and his men. They had two choices. They could stand pat and freeze to death, or they could keep trudging miserably along. This fact never occurred to Daniel Shays or any of the men under his command. Of course Lincoln was going to stop. Why wouldn't Lincoln stop? It's freezing out here. So when Lincoln arrived at 9 a.m. in Petersham and had his half-frozen men bring the cannons forward, it was pretty much completely over. Most of Shays' army was still asleep when Lincoln arrived, and they were caught completely off guard. The miserable conditions and somewhat rough terrain did slow down Lincoln's army enough that most of Shays' men, including all of the leadership, were able to slip away and avoid capture. Shays himself would slip into New Hampshire, along with much of the leadership. And that was it. The rebellion was over. For everything that it had been built up to be, it ended with little more than a whimper. There would still be the occasional hotspot to put out, small bands of uprisings, but it would never again galvanize into a bigger movement. Although the legislature was seemingly out for blood, only around 24 men would ever actually face trial. Of those convicted, most of them were either pardoned or had their sentences commuted. Daniel Shays himself would get a pardon in 1788 and would end up living until 1825, when he died in upstate New York. It is interesting that Shays' rebellion had such an anticlimactic end, especially considering the role that we often prescribe to it today. The fallout from the rebellion would be felt far beyond the constraints of Massachusetts, and would indeed play an important role throughout the first half of 1787 at illustrating the weakness of the Confederation and the need for reform. During our next episode, we are going to explore the legacy of the rebellion and work on placing it into the greater overall context of its time, and discuss exactly how the uprising would become such a critical moment on the march to the Philadelphia Convention later that year. Next time, we are going to discuss the road to the Constitutional Convention and explore the effects on that movement that derived out of Shays' rebellion. Until then, I hope you all have a wonderful 2 weeks. I hope that you are staying healthy and that you are staying safe. And I will see you back here next time as everybody marches towards the Constitutional Convention.